treason, sedition, rebellion. This is the heritage of the American patriot. Those revolutionaries who stood on principle to fight against tyranny no matter the cost. And that spirit lives strong today in the activists and freedom fighters who fight against the authoritarian state. Each in their own way, each with their own mission, united for the cause.
I had the idea to run on a platform of fuck the police prior to actually winning the primary.
I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
They said, you don't get to tell us no, we're the state health department. And I said, hell no.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
People already pushing back in ways that didn't even need any votes to be cast.
I'm not ratting on anybody, and I did what I did, so you're going to have to give me what the law says you have to give me.
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Hope I don't get canceled. Talk to you.
These are the people whose stories I'm here to share. I'm Justin O'Donnell, and this is Submersive.
Man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, anarchists, shitposters, and people of the internet, thank you for tuning in to episode number 80 of Subversive. I'm your host, Justin O'Donnell, and before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you listen on, whether it's YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on the air at LRN.fm, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and most of all, sharing with your friends. If you enjoy this show and its content, you can join our insurgency by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell. And make sure to check out our sponsor, SnackSwag.com, where you can get all your favorite Subversive and Liberty merch, including some brand new designs for official podcast merch for t-shirts, hoodies, coffee mugs, and more. Again, that's SnackSwag.com. And you can check out their awesome new collection of official merch today. Now, if you want to keep in touch between shows, follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans of the show at any time. All these links can be found in the description of the video or podcast that you're listening to. And once again, give them a visit today. Now, today's topic, this week's topic, something near and dear to my heart, something we want to cover. Once again, I want to thank you all for attending the first official hearing of the committee on unlibertarian activities. Once again, we're delving into the drama of the internet and taking the excuse to discuss the issues at length while boiling down the ethics in question from the perspective of liberty. So what kind of hot topic do we have for ourselves tonight? Well, it's a fun one. Communism, McCarthyism, and a poorly worded tweet where the intent was lost to the subjective interpretation of the readers. Now, what am I talking about when I say a poorly worded tweet? Now, that's going to be basically the gist of this whole thing of where we're getting started. So let me bring up a tweet. There, y'all might be a little bit surprised. I was a little bit surprised when I saw this. And it's not actually that bad in reality where the Libertarian Party tweets, look at Herbert Marcuse and Paulo Freire's influence on the K-12 education system. It's time to deal with the American communists for real. A quote from James Lindsay, Conceptual James on Twitter, accompanied by a meme where James Lindsay, invoking Senator Joseph McCarthy, says McCarthy was wrong. He underestimated the communist threat in America. James Lindsay, as controversial of a figure as he is not really the subject of conversation here, not who's to be discussed or whatever. But at least the headline reads right. McCarthy was wrong. We'll dive into that in a little bit. But as a whole, the tweet doesn't land because it leaves too much to interpretation. And there's a lot to be said about marketing and the way you craft your message and who you choose to quote. And when you're bringing up unprincipled people like Joseph McCarthy, you need to be really, really clear what you're endorsing. Is it just an idea they had or was it their whole plan? Because Joseph McCarthy was a horrible human being who had a horrible influence on the United States. Invoking him, even on something he was right, leaves you open to sending the wrong message. Now, at least the headline reads right. McCarthy was wrong. But the substance of the tweet sent out on August 6th sparked confusion, outrage, anger, and resentment towards the communications team of the new Libertarian National Committee. A tweet centered around James Lindsay. He's been recently banned from Twitter and is a commentary on the communist subversion of the American public education system. He talks a lot about education system and cultural Marxism and communist influence and how it's affecting the American education system. That's kind of his bit. That's kind of his shtick. That's kind of all he does. But the controversial nature of the tweet and its issues has to do with the context of two quotes provided together. The quote of the tweet and the quote on the graphic that accompanies it, and invoking the era of McCarthyism with the graphic, where James Lindsay says McCarthy was wrong. He underestimated the threat. But then in the quoted text, it says it's time to deal with the American communists for real. The debate in outreach doesn't hinge on the question of whether or not there is a communist threat, or if the American education system has been corrupted beyond salvation. Hint, hint, it has. Rather, the anger and commentary revolve around Lindsay's call to action to finally deal with communists in America, which was received by everyone reading this tweet. A lot of people reading this tweet, most people, myself included at first, to be an endorsement of McCarthy's strategies and actions and the McCarthyist era of American politics, a call to finally deal with American communists while at the same time invoking Joseph McCarthy and claiming he didn't go understand the problem went far enough. Now, as a U.S. senator, Joseph McCarthy used his position on the to launch public crusades, weaponizing the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which he didn't even sit on. He was a senator. He wasn't in the House of Representatives and didn't partake or participate in the House Committee on Un-American Activities. He just manipulated their proceedings and the public outcry and public sentiment around them, kind of the early days of modern televised yellow journalism. But he used this to launch public crusades against suspected communist infiltrators and sympathizers, people he disagreed with, people he had problems with, people who his friends had problems with, people in media, in politics, in Hollywood, and in art who he had problems with, government employees, prominent business people, politicians, and private citizens were all subjected to harassing witch hunts and crusades, blacklists, losing jobs, ending up in jail. There were multiple suicides based on the due to the harassment of the accusations and show trials held by the House Un-American Activities Commission, all on the basis of wrong think. You had the wrong ideas. You didn't think the approved things, so we're going to drag you through the mud. Now, a little history here before we dive in. The House Un-American Activities Committee was actually first formed in 1934, way predates McCarthy or the McCarthyist era of American anti-communist politics. It was founded by the McCormick-Dickinson Committee. Whoop, crazy cat. McCormick-Dickinson Committee, by congressional resolution proposed and sponsored by New York Congressman Samuel Dickstein. Crazy thing is, Samuel Dickstein, after serving on this committee, eventually resigned from Congress to accept a post being elevated to the Supreme Court of New York. He himself, posthumously, after the capturing of Russian intelligence and Soviet archives, was confirmed to have actually been a Soviet spy himself. So the House Un-American Activities Commission was actually started by a Soviet spy, just a color about their actions and how they worked. But the official charge of the committee was being to investigate how foreign subversive propaganda, ding, 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 see what I'm talking about, entered the United States. They quickly narrowed the scope and used it to persistently pursue suspected fascist and communist infiltrators working within government. In fact, crazily enough, the first investigation of the committee was the circumstances of an incident known to history as the Wall Street Putsch, or taught as the Business Plot, or the Robber Baron Plot. It was a 1933 attempted coup, where a bunch of wealthy businessmen upset about the talk of going off the gold standard, who were upset with American economic practices at the time, and upset with the liberalization of the U.S. government and President Roosevelt, and actually formed a plot to stage a coup using an army of disgruntled World War I veterans known as the Bonus Army, led by retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler. Many of you might know Smedley Butler from as the author of War is a Racket, one of the great pieces of anti-war literature that we have accessible today. Somebody from the inside of the system who's keenly aware of what the military-industrial complex was and what it was building to and what it was creating and what we needed to fear from it. General Butler was also an avowed anti-capitalist. He was a socialist himself. Ding, ding, ding. Who often wrote and preached about the dangers of capitalism as encouraging warfare and war profiteering and the racketeering of businessmen. But he was greatly respected amongst U.S. servicemen and veterans. And so this group of individuals, which included a number of highly ranked military officials and business people, including the CEO of J.P. Morgan, Thomas Lamont, and Prescott Bush, great-grandfather of President George W. Bush, were involved in organizing this coup to have General Butler, General Smedley Butler, lead the Bonus Army to depose President Roosevelt, install Smedley Butler as the new Secretary of General Affairs, which would be a nearly unlimited in power dictator over all internal and domestic affairs for the United States, and leaving President Roosevelt as a mere figurehead with a new constitution. This was supposed to be an armed revolt, an armed coup. And General Butler testified to this fact. General Smedley Butler approached the committee, approached Congress, having second thoughts, withdrawing from the plan, ratted out his co-conspirators to the committee. And the first hearings of the McCormick Committee were on the Wall Street Putsch, where General Butler testified and willingly provided all the information on his co-conspirators, including Prescott Bush, Thomas Lamont, Grayson Murphy, Robert Sterling Clark, half a dozen admirals and generals in the armed forces. And despite these revelations and the committee's report confirming the allegations through its investigations, no arrests were ever made. Not a single arrest was ever made. And in fact, the committee's report said that even with all the evidence, even with the firsthand testimony of General Butler, individuals such as Thomas Lamont, Prescott Bush, and Grayson Murphy had tried to recruit him to help lead the Bonus Army in a coup to march on Washington, and that their backup plan was actually for General MacArthur, and MacArthur laughed at it publicly and said he was never asked. No arrest was ever made, and the committee said it wouldn't be worthwhile to pursue them. So in its earliest days, this committee was toothless. They, like most congressional committees, held a hearing to talk a lot and ended up doing nothing. But despite the toothless nature of this committee at its onset and at outset, it slowly evolved over time. And by the time Dickstein, while we now know was still on the payroll of Soviet intelligence services, left Congress, ascending to the New York Supreme Court, the committee had actually become a permanent standing committee in Congress. And its charge had been narrowed to rooting out communism, because that was the big threat in post-World War II America, was communism, communism, communism. And while the committee may have actually uncovered some Soviet agents and infiltrators, nobody disputes their effectiveness in having done so. More often than not, it was just ordinary Americans, loyal and patriotic in their own ways, maybe not high dandy signing up for the armed forces or willing to throw their neighbors under the bus, but just wanting to live and let live, who were accused because their values and their morals led them to be held as an ideological enemy of those in charge, whether it was Dickstein or McCormick or McCarthy. It wasn't limited to socialist agitators. I mean, accusations of communist sympathy were used to disrupt civil rights activists, labor unions, political organizers, anyone Joseph McCarthy deemed to be a threat to the American ideology and way of life, and included a significant chunk of Hollywood along with it. It wasn't simply Soviet spies such as Alger Hiss that the committee confirmed. It was, they blacklisted and interrogated hundreds of actors, writers, and Hollywood producers who were driven from the country or forced out of the industry altogether, including notable names like Charlie Chaplin, who may have had some socialist leanings. I don't know. I've seen The Great Dictator. Charlie Chaplin doesn't come off as the most gung-ho patriotic guy. He comes off as someone who believes in the utopian patriotic ideals that socialism preaches and talks about, never actually accomplishes or achieves, but he's an actor. He made great films. Nobody had a problem with him when they were silent, but when he opened his mouth with The Great Dictator, he was dragged before the House Un-American Activities Commission and blacklisted from Hollywood. It's not a good way to do things. free speech is one of our most important and fundamental rights. The ability to say what you think, no matter how controversial, no matter how angry it might make you. We see cases today with Alex Jones having to settle a defamation suit for $50 million, attempting to destroy his platform, his ability to reach. I don't care. He's a performance artist. He's a comedian. One day we're going to look back at Alex Jones like Van Gogh or Beethoven. He's an artist, not a real news commentator. You don't get that red in the face unless you're doing something involving your heart. But the conspiracy, the gall of the conspiracy theorists to tell the parents of Sandy Hook school shooting survivors to their faces it was made up and wasn't real. Nobody took him seriously. Certainly wasn't $50 million worth of damage. But nobody has a right to tell you you can't speak. You can't say these things. Because if you shut down disinformation without knowing what the real information is, what's next? It's me. It's you. It's Reed Coverdale. It's Josh Smith. It's James Lindsay, who's recently canceled from Twitter. It's us who are next on the chopping block for free speech. No different than it was anyone who dissented or was deemed to be in the wrong by McCarthyist tactics that was put on the chopping block of the House Un-American Activities Commission. President Harry Truman remarked that the committee itself was the most un-American thing in the country, because its very nature was an attack on free thought, free speech, and political dissidence. The actions and tactics of the committee and its supporters, such as Senator McCarthy, were an insult to the notions of liberty, libertarian ideals, classical liberalism, and the freedoms that this country was founded on. While some do still to this day see value in opposing ideologies as invasive and harmful as communism, many actually overlook the dangers of embracing the tactics of our enemy to do so. William Bennett, in his series America, the Last Best Hope, in covering the post-war period of America, wrote that the cause of anti-communism, which united millions of Americans and which gained the support of Democrats, Republicans, and independents, was undermined by Senator Joe McCarthy. McCarthy addressed a real problem, disloyal elements within the U.S. government, but his approach to this real problem was to cause untold grief to the country he claimed to love. Worst of all, McCarthy besmirched the honorable cause of anti-communism. He discredited legitimate efforts to counter Soviet subversion of American institutions. He published that in 2007, The Last Best Hope for America, The Last Best Hope by William Bennett. I think that's an important thing to realize, though, that when you go so hard and angrily against what you hate, you subvert honest attempts to fight it. Libertarians and liberty-loving conservatives are among the fringes of political and cultural ideology. We are a minority and one at constant risk of oppression from the democratic whims of the masses. For nearly 50 years, the Libertarian Party has attempted to pursue a strategy of recruitment and education, hoping to bring more people to our side through the logical power of our views. What those embracing the strategy failed to understand utterly is that what makes a libertarian a minority is that our political philosophy is based on a moral and ethical framework that the majority of people don't share. Libertarianism, to me, is not merely a political philosophy. It's a way of life. It is a moral and ethical philosophy first. It's how you live your life and how you apply that those values and that culture to politics in governing others. Whereas Republicans and Democrats tend to have shared values about right and wrong, just different discretion on how forcefully they're willing to apply it to others. Libertarians embrace a philosophy of consent and respect for property rights inherent in individual self-ownership and naturally align against the tyranny of the collective majority. And for that reason, will also naturally, inevitably become its target. There's an old piece of wisdom that you should never take any power for yourself that you would fear your worst enemy use against you. Because an opposing ideology is to threaten us, we must be wary of supporting the growth of institutions and practices that will inevitably be turned against us. The minority seeking freedom and liberty and ownership of self. Now, while there does lie a danger in adopting the methods of tyrants in an attempt to preserve our liberty, that does not make the threat of communism and its cultural machinations any less real. In fact, McCarthy was right in his assertion that a communist subversion of America, American culture, was underway, even while being wrong in his push to become a tyrant to oppose it. Like, what he underestimated, though, was not the long-term threat of communism, but rather its existing success in subverting the legislative processes and systems governing the United States, even at the time which he was writing it. He was trying to prevent a communist takeover of the United States, when in reality, communists had already conquered American culture. And if you don't believe me, in 1847, Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. And in that Communist Manifesto, he outlines a whole lot. The Communist Manifesto, if you've not read it, you should. Everyone should. It's not that long. It's only about 100 pages. Real quick to get through. But he outlined a process to subvert a nation's culture and a government in order to implement communism, whether by violent revolution, native adoption, what takes many by surprise is the extent to which most Western nations, including the United States, have already adopted the tenets of the Communist Manifesto, particularly the 10 key planks in the model of governance to subvert a developed nation into a communist state. The reality is we weren't being threatened by communism. We were living under it already. Now, in the Communist Manifesto, you can find these planks. You can find the whole manifesto of Karl Marx and Engels and their ideas. But particularly what I want to look at is in Chapter 2, Proletarians and Communists. And this is courtesy free of Marxist.org. They don't believe in intellectual property or making money. So that's how we're able to get this for free and publish it, because they're Marxists. Respect their wishes. But right at the end of chapter two, all the way at the end of chapter two, is this list of 10 planks. The measures, of course, will be different in different countries. Nevertheless, in most advanced countries, the following will be pretty generally applicable. For advanced Western countries, these are the 10 planks to communist subversion. Plank number one. Let's go line by line. How the United States has already succumbed to communism. How the United States has already succumbed to being a communist state. We're not fighting a war of prevention, but a war of escape. Plank number one, the abolition of property in land and application of all rents to public purpose. Now, if you've never heard me talk about it before, I do believe one of the most egregious taxes in the scam of government, in the system of governance under which we live, is the property tax. Because the property tax is the one tax you can't opt out of, because no matter where you live, whether you rent, whether you own, whether you homestead, the property tax is the one methodology the state has by which to force you to use their currency, to use their blood money, to support their financial and federal infrastructure and their warmongering. Because if you don't pay your property tax, they send men with guns to steal your property. It's the most egregious of taxes. This is a tax on property. Because through this claim of ownership, the state has decreed that you can't own land or the structures built upon it without paying tribute to their public treasury. For the supposed public good, of course. Failure to pay such a tribute to the state results in the seizure of your property, the eviction of your occupancy, the termination of rights of ownership, and the sale of that property on the public market to benefit the state, not you. You don't see the proceeds of that sale. They go towards ostensibly paying your back taxes, but any overage the state keeps for its troubles. Property taxes are inherently and always will be the most egregious of taxes. And property tax and eminent domain laws and zoning regulations, city planning, all of these institutions of modern land management and land use has effectively abolished property and land and the application of all rents, your taxes, on that land to the public purpose, the public treasury, the public schools, the public infrastructure, the roads. Plank one, done. Plank two, a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Now, I don't know if you don't know this or not, but the United States tax code is 6,871 pages long. That's just the actual statutes and tax codes. If you include the federal tax regulations, the CFRs, and the official tax guidance prepared by the IRS, the number of pages rises somewhere north of 75,000. The average reader, the average human being of, you know, high school or college education level with the typically average reading speed, it's estimated it would take about 14 weeks of 40 hours a week of reading to finish the 75,000 pages. This is onerous, it's complex, it's rules, regulations. It is impossible for any individual to comprehend in its entirety. And if you can't comprehend it in its entirety as an individual, then asking people to comprehend it in its entirety as a group is a recipe for confusion, mix-ups, heavy-handed mistakes, and it is impossible to get right. Yet, you're legally bound to it. Well, it's impossible to understand. It governs the forfeiture of your income. Every individual is legally bound to it. Any failure to comply properly or pay in full results in fines levied and occasional incarceration. They'll put you in a cage if you don't tell them. And there's an old joke of the process of the income tax. The way it works is the IRS shows up every year, once a year. They say, hey, you owe me some money. Okay, how much do I owe you? I don't know, but you should figure it out. I should figure it out? Well, what happens if I guess wrong? I'll kill you. Because they'll send a man with a gun to steal your shit and put you in a cage, because that's how government works. And the IRS just announced they're hiring 87,000 new agents. Ladies and gentlemen, there are less than 1,000 billionaires in this country, but they're hiring 87,000 agents. This isn't an audit of the wealthy or the super rich. It's an audit of the middle class. They're coming for you and for me and the average American who might not have lied but just missed a box because there's something left to take. Plank number two, check. Plank number three, the abolition of all rights of inheritance. I'll admit we're not quite there yet. We don't, but we do have a death tax. We do have inheritance taxes. We do have a process by which the United States government interferes in the process of inheritance. We have income taxes. We make it very difficult for people to amass and accumulate wealth to leave to their descendants and to pass on property subject to probate. And the court system set up by the government specifically to interfere with inheritance and property rights within a family. Even your last legal will of testament can be challenged and overruled on the whims of the state. You don't have a right to determine the disposition of your property upon your death. Your inheritance don't have any right to claim it. It's all entirely at the whims of the state. So, well, we have not yet abolished the right of inheritance. Senators like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and others on the progressive left and the hyper-progressive are actually openly advocating for that on a regular basis. They want an inheritance tax. They don't believe you should be allowed to inherit wealth. You didn't earn it. You didn't create it. You can't inherit it. That's next on the chopping block, folks. It's not long around the corner because it's on the agenda. It's on the platform and what we're moving towards. So plank number three, half check, we're almost there. Plank number four, the confiscation of property of all immigrants and rebels. Often confused with immigrants and rebels. Immigrants means a different thing, though. For those of you educated out there, it means those trying to flee or leave the country, not those trying to come in. Because who the fuck wants to come into a communist state? They're not worried about immigrants. They're worried about people leaving and trying to take with them what's theirs. But the United States has an exit tax. You got to pay a fee and a fine to renounce your U.S. citizenship. You got to pay taxes on the way out. They'll seize your assets, freeze your bank accounts. And beyond that, we have a process in place to do this for rebels. All you got to do is accuse them of being such as a crime. The process of civil and criminal asset forfeiture is known to be one of the most corrupt law enforcement and legal practices in the United States. Law enforcement agencies routinely seize private property of individuals on the mere suspicion of a crime with no conviction, no due process, no thorough investigation, no reasonable or articulable suspicion. They simply seize money. In fact, you can look in the federal court bat logs and find a number of cases, United States versus $25,000, United States versus imported Japanese shark fins, property seized, property stolen. Because property doesn't have rights, people have rights. You're entitled to due process, but your money isn't. Your money is a debt instrument that's the property of the United States government, and it's in their interest to say and to argue that it's theirs to take when they want. All it's going to take is one upstart attorney general and a governor, or maybe a mayor, or the chief of a local police department or state police, or maybe Attorney General Merrick Garland, to just declare that the property's assets and accounts of anybody accused of rebel activity, sedition, treason, or slander against the state to be seized, frozen, and confiscated in an act of forfeiture, of which you have no right of recovery. Plank number four, I'm going to call it a check, because all the tools are there. They just haven't used it. Plank number five. The centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. If you're watching this show, I assume I don't need to explain this to you. If you've made it this far, I assume you have a notion about what the Federal Reserve is. If you haven't, go read The Creature from Jekyll Island. Go watch anything Ron Paul has put out in the past 40 years. Go listen to any libertarian candidate speak on any issue at any time. The Federal Reserve is one of the most corrupt and damaging institutions in the world. In the creation of the Federal Reserve System, Alexander Hamilton should have been shot earlier, if you ask me, and central banking in the United States, it predates the writing of the Communist Manifesto. Like, for all I know, Marx got the idea from Alexander Hamilton and the United States, but the United States Federal Reserve has existed since fucking forever, but it maintains a monopoly on currency and lending. They manipulate the value of the dollar. They influence markets. It's a private bank. It's not even a government branch or a government agency, but they are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. military's ability to assassinate any world leader that opposes them. Muammar Gaddafi threatened to go off the U.S. dollar and switch back to gold standard for trading petrol oil in Libya. Next thing you know, Hillary Clinton was laughing about having him killed on national television. It's allowed the United States to manipulate the global economic market for a long time. And so we're going to call Plank 5 a check, because you don't have savings. You have debt instruments owned by the U.S. Federal Reserve. You call them dollars, but they might not be worth shit for much longer. Inflation's at over 9%, and China and Russia have just announced that they're forming their own reserve currency to get themselves off the dollar. Whether that means we're going to go to war with China or heat up this proxy war in Ukraine against Russia, who knows? But the United States has a fucking hard-on for killing people who don't like the dollar, so we'll see. Plank 5, check. Plank 6, centralization of the means of communication and transport at the hands of the state. This is a long one. This is you ever wonder why libertarians hate roads? Well, the hyper-regulation of public roadways, public transit systems, it's been the rule in not just the United States, but most Western countries for a long time, the United States included, with the federal interstate highway system being the backbone of our national transportation network and arterial road networks, just more localized extensions of the Department of Transportation through state and local municipalities just to manage it. It's unfathomable that there's any way you can engage in the act of transportation without being licensed, regulated, and taxed into compliance with state control of your activities. In fact, the Interstate Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution says if you're transporting shit across state lines, That and that alone gives the United States federal government the right to have their nose in any and every aspect of what you're doing. The Department of Transportation exists within the federal government solely for the reason of centralizing management of these roadways and the vehicles which travel upon them. Air travel is even more regulated with a whole host of agencies involved in this oversight, including the TSA, the FAA, the National Transportation Safety Board, Department of Transportation, dozens of others. And God forbid you want to move something by boat, because now you're not only dealing with NTSB, DOT, Department of Homeland Security, the Coast Guard, the TSA, but also the United Nations. The international law governs boat travel. Whew, that gets nasty. You want to dive into the United Nations International Convention on the Law of the Sea sometime? That might be a whole episode, but we'll do it for you. Communications infrastructure, too. It's not just the means of transport, it's the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. This one's a little trickier because communications infrastructure is technology, and it advances at a very, very rapid rate. Faster than we can counter, usually. Faster than the government can keep up with, usually. We went from the telephone to the internet and lightning speed in the grand scope of human history. But the state does its best with the FCC, FEC, the Telecom Act, breaking up of cable telecom monopolies with Ma Bell, regulating cable internet with Section 230, Communication Decency Act. Now they're going after social media. Every advent that challenges the governing body's ability to regulate communication, the U.S. government sticks its nose and does its best to muck it up. They persist in the attempt. It's without controlling communication, they can't control how information is shared and spread amongst people. It's among their highest priorities to control and dictate how information spreads, not just what the information is spreading. Blank six is a check. They control it. Blank seven, the extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state, the bringing into cultivation of wastelands, and the improvement of soil generally in accordance with a common plan. Ladies and gentlemen, Plank 7, I give you the Green New Deal. We're not there yet, but they're trying. They've been trying for a long time. The United States federal government is the single largest landowner in the country. The majority of all land west of the Mississippi is owned by the government. It's in states, but it's owned by the federal government. The Bureau of Land Management exists to tell people what they're allowed to do on their own land at times, federal land at others. The Green New Deal, though, is that's the rallying cry. That's bringing this to fruition at every level. The progressive agenda wants to regulate all production, all industry, within the confines of environmental standards to improve the soils, bring into cultivation the wastes. The single common plan of acceptable actions. The Green New Deal tells you what you can make, how you can make it, how much you can let your cows fart, and what you're even allowed to eat. With the subsidization of select sectors of the energy industry, solar, wind, fuck nuclear, right? Fuck the fact that science has known the answer to climate change for four decades, but the left and the liberals have been afraid to let it happen. Solar, not nuclear. That's what they want. Solar. It's like they've never seen the pictures of the aftermath of a lithium strip mine. The desolation of an entire ecosystem to get the raw materials needed to make a battery. Seven's not there yet, folks, but the check mark's coming. Plank number eight, the equal liability of all to labor. The establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. Well, the central mismanagement of currency by the Federal Reserve, we covered that in the banking monopoly, is created a system of consistent inflation that continually robs Americans of their ability to save and plan for retirement. Doesn't matter what you put in the bank, it's going to be worth a fraction of that by the time you need it. With forced reliance on Social Security system for end-of-life care, infirmity care, health care with Medicare, Medicaid, the Americans are compelled to labor for the benefit of the state and its corporations, as opposed to their own betterment and their own enjoyment. Like, people don't work to live anymore. People don't work to create anymore. People don't work for passion anymore. They work to get by, to pay the rent, to pay the bills, to consume. And 75% of Americans don't have $500 in the bank. I think 10% of Americans or less are prepared for an emergency $500 expense without taking out a loan or credit. We're not far off from a third world communist state, folks. We're 8 planks in and 5 of them been spot on and the other 3 almost there. But with the average American unable to afford housing and the necessities of life due to state manipulation of markets and currencies, a troop private and small businesses regulated out of existence, and the inevitability of state-enabled corporate monopolies and rent-seeking behaviors by megacorporations acting as a subsidiary of the state to control a monopoly of labor is a near certainty in the near future, unless you opt out and work around it. Plank 9, the combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries, the gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country, by a more equable distribution of the population over the country. I might ruffle some feathers with the libertarian crowd here. I might really, really trigger some of the Mises Caucus and people on the right, but Plank 9 is not only complete, it wasn't completed by the government, it was completed by private industry, private companies, corporations, leveraging the power of the state with their rent-seeking behavior to force this upon us. The federal government is taking an explicit interest in the regulation of farmlands and public lands, like as we mentioned, the Bureau of Land Management and other agencies that exist solely to regulate the use of land. The majority of the land in the United States is not held privately, but is property of the federal government. And with a modern push towards the corporate consolidation of ownership as a de facto arm of the state, we're seeing a transition towards managed distribution of population and centralized management of resources. Bill Gates is the largest farmland owner in this country. The Gates Foundation, a rent-seeking corporation that spends millions of dollars a year lobbying politicians to pass new laws, increase new restrictions on business, and put competition out of business across all sectors, is now the largest farm owner in the country and the largest arable landowner in the country. BlackRock might as well be an arm of the state. They're the investment firm for Congress. They handle the retirement pensions and IRAs and 401ks of the people who want to destroy your life at every whim. BlackRock has spent billions of dollars, a lot of it gained in taxpayer-subsidized bailouts, to monopolize the housing market, causing this recent housing bubble with prices skyrocketing above previous market highs and market norms, all while engaging in legislative rent-seeking to regulate their competition out of the market. These private actors like BlackRock, like the Gates Foundation, AFL-CIO, labor and corporations have worked hand-in-hand to destroy this country. Private business working at the behest of the state is what we call fascism. It's not really communism. But we'll get to that later. I mean, the difference between fascism and communism is virtually fucking negligible at this point. Because private businesses are capable of oppression. They're capable of tyranny. And they can do so far more effectively than the state and efficiently. And we've reached a point in our history, in our economic climate, and our culture, where private business, mega corporations, engage in rent-seeking, lobbying, and political activism to dictate the shape of the law to their own financial benefit has destroyed this country and what it possibly could have been. We've reached that phase of fascism on Plank 9. Might not be pure communism, but I don't draw a distinction between BlackRock and the state government, too, is just ready to step in. Plank number 10, free education for all children in public schools, and the abolition of children's factory labor in its present form, combination of education with industrial production. Ladies and gentlemen, the libertarians were right once again when the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire caused a whole bunch of drama that flung the party and the liberty movement into chaos with a single tweet arguing that child labor should be legalized. Well, you really want to fight communism, you should legalize child labor because we outlawed that, and that was one of Marx's planks. Clearly, we were doing something right in this country before the commies stepped in. But Free education for all. That's the standard. Public schools are the standard. Access to free taxpayer-funded K through 12 education at government schools has become the standard and the backbone of the American educational system in the past 150 years. The reality is that this system is more of a substitute for childcare than education, but that's lost on most people who rely on it. And while there's a growing movement for school choice and educational alternatives across the school, with great minds like Corey DeAngelis making waves, and government-managed indoctrination centers have become the default in our society. And they are government-managed indoctrination centers. They are prisons for children. As Michael Malice says, a public school is likely the only place most Americans will ever experience violence. Your average American will experience violence against them, their bodies, and their persons, and their property. Almost without exception at some point in their life. And for the vast majority of Americans, the only time that happens is in government schools. They are prisons used to indoctrinate children, not to teach them. The quality of education collapsed. It's downhill. Children have been left ill-prepared to deal with the realities of the working world because they weren't taught to work. They weren't taught skills that they could use upon leaving the indoctrination center. Yet, there remains stiff cultural and political opposition to allowing parents to take charge of their kids' educational outcomes. So Plank 10 is not only done. Plank 10 was probably done before Marx wrote this goddamn manifesto. But anyways, that's the case for our dictatorship of the proletariat, as Marx would put it. The United States is a dictatorship of the majority. It's tyranny of the majority. That's what the tyranny of the majority is, all that democracy is. Democracy, the tyranny of the majority, the democracy, the oppression of the minority at every turn. But Marx would call it the dictatorship of the proletariat. It's a fancy word for the working folk. So, in all but open admission, the United States is as much a communist state as the Soviet Union could have ever claimed to be at its height. That's really the only difference between the United States today and the Soviet Union at its height is the number of political parties cooperating to subjugate people. In the Soviet Union, there was only one official party, the Communist Party. It implemented its goals and programs with no resistance and unilateral control. In the United States, there's two parties. They have at least nominal differences, but they cooperate to implement the tenets of socialism covertly under the guise of bipartisanship and compromise. But in reality, it's communism. There are other political parties. It's not just two. Let me back off before I make the libertarians mad, too. There is other political parties, and for sure, libertarians are the oldest and largest of the minor political parties. But in 50 plus years, the Libertarian Party has been attempting to gain a foothold of political legitimacy. It had a muted impact at best, no impact at worst. And most states have never seen a libertarian elected. The United States federal legislature has never seen a libertarian elected in an open election. I've seen one libertarian switch parties near the end of a lame duck term where he wasn't up for re-election. The small handful of state legislators that have been elected or defected from the other parties end up left powerless and ineffective at their prescribed tasks because they don't cooperate and work within the system. The Libertarian Party's perpetual fight is just maintaining their right to even appear on the ballot every 2 years. Ballot access. Such a persistent fight that this entire news outlet, Ballot Access News, run by Richard Wenger, dedicated to talking about how libertarians can get on the ballot year-round. It's such a problem that there's an entire industry of ballot access petitioners that travel the country just to get libertarians on the ballot. There's money in it. Fucking libertarians spend money on some shit. I don't know. Is it worth it? We have to keep asking ourselves this. Is it worth it? Is the constant fight worth it? How can our movement, which again, circling back to the beginning here, based on a fringe ideology, a fringe moral and ethical compass, libertarianism, how can it flourish in the United States and defend itself against the institutional and cultural encroachment of communism? It must refrain from any hint that it's adopting tactics similar to McCarthy era fascism. Because that's what it was. McCarthyism was fascism. For sure. Using the state in the same manner communists would, but allowing private business to do the oppression for you. That's fascism. Not much different, see? Must also fight against having any appearance that we're willing to embrace the communists' cultural willingness to subjugate their enemies with the force of the state. We can't force people to be libertarian. It's a philosophy of consent. It's an ethical framework of consent. People need to consent to being free. You can't free somebody if they don't know they're in chains to begin with, but that's another problem. If people don't consent to what we consider to be free, then we cannot force it upon them. So how do we deal with this? We're on a twofold approach. First, we realize that the tendencies of fascists and communists are more alike with each other than with us. And then free ourselves from the possibility of majority oppression by escaping our stature as minorities. But Justin, how do we escape our stature as minorities, you ask? By leaving. That's the only way, by leaving. Economist Friedrich Hayek, most libertarians know him. You should, if you've gotten to this point, know who he is. If you haven't, you're going to go read his book after this. It's fantastic. He spent about half his life in his native Austria during the rise of European fascism. And the remainder of his life in the UK and the US. He wrote in The Road to Serfdom how he feared that many of the elements that had led to Germany's demise were already underway in the United States, and that the differences between fascism and communism were dwarfed by their similarities. He described fascism as the stage reached after communism has proved an illusion. Now, this is one of my favorite quotes in political discourse I've just brought up. It's over on Goodreads, and I'll make sure you get the link to that. But it's true, of course, that in Germany before 1933 and in Italy before 1922, communists and Nazis, or fascists, clashed more frequently with each other than with other parties. They competed for the support of the same type of mind and reserved for each other the hatred of the heretic. But their practice showed how closely they are related to both the real enemy, the man with whom they had nothing in common, whom they could not hope to convince, is the liberal of the old type. Well, to the Nazi and the communist, and to the communist and the Nazi, and to both the socialists are potential recruits who are made of the right timber. Although they have listened to false prophets, they both know that there can be no compromise between them and those who really believe in individual freedom. Friedrich Hayek in The Road to Serfdom. 1944, he wrote that. The dawn of McCarthyist post-war politics in the United States. As a moral and ethical minority, libertarians, conservatives, classical liberals who live in cultures dominated by collectivist tendencies, democracy will always oppress. Our ideological enemies will always have the majority. So the answer is to cast off the chains of the predominant culture and to seek peace through a community with others of like minds and to share their values. The Free State Project. Intentional migration, 20,000 libertarians to the Free State of New Hampshire, has had a tremendous impact on the relative level of freedom, culture, and politics within the small state where their adherents have been relocating, with a focus on building community and impacting politics at the most local level. Libertarians have had a significant impact on the culture of government in New Hampshire, to the point where the majority coalition of legislators in the state's House of Representatives can be reasonably claimed to be libertarians or at least cultural allies. This is a huge paradigm shift. I know of no other place in the country or even the world, okay? Say that out loud. No other place in the country or the world where libertarians are protested against, because we've been so effective at creating cultural change and cultural impact here like we have in the state of New Hampshire. Like, I'll bring up this picture for you. If you can see it, this is Democrats out at Keene City Common, the Common downtown Keene. Democrats meeting to protest against libertarians and free staters. Have you ever been protested against? It's a damn good feeling. Because people don't protest against you unless you have power and you're winning. And the progressives and hyper-progressives and leftists and socialists and communists and fascists here in New Hampshire protest against the successes of the Free State Project and of libertarians. That's amazing. It's incredible. Well-funded organizations such as Granite State Progress and Free State Project Watch have sprung up, funded by establishment dark money, Soros and the Clintons. Where the fuck they get their money from? Overseas, probably. Oil money, war money. Raytheon money, for the sole purpose of opposing the growing influence of free staters and libertarians in New Hampshire. Nowhere else in the country are libertarians effective enough to be given the time of day by their establishment opposition. So on that note, I'm going to leave you with the only effective defense against your own oppression is to live with those that share your values and clearly communicate in a manner that does not subvert your own intent. Learn more about the Free State Project, plan a visit to Liberty Forum or Pork Fest, and make a plan to join your tribe in living free instead of fighting for the scraps of liberty the establishment chooses to allow you to have. Thank you, everybody, for joining me tonight. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for watching. Thank you for putting up with a cat who hates the camera, but she's a little lover and attention whore, and we love her, Berna. Get over here. Folks, if you haven't hit that like button, do so. If you haven't hit that subscribe button, do so. Leave a comment down below to let me know what you thought of the show and what we talked about. Leave a comment below and let me know what you thought about the Libertarian National Party's tweet. Hit that link tree in the description. Go and visit our Substack. You can get my afterthoughts. You can get the written out version of this show and our plan. And you can get keep in touch with what we're working on here in New Hampshire moving forward. Big shout out to our patrons and members of the Insurgency who keep this show going and keep everything above board on our top tier. We have the one and only Mike Dalgleish, Stefan Kinsella, Jeremy Slacha, Jeremy Kaufman, Robert Daniel, Josh Richard, and Antonio Spaghetti. You can join them, help support the show, earn some great perks over on patreon.com/O'Donnell. Well, folks, that's our time for the night. It's been real. It's been fun. It's been free. And until next time, thank you, and stay free. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Subversive. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live on YouTube. And make sure to leave some comments and reviews on whatever platform you listen on to let me know what you thought of this episode. And a huge thanks and shout out to our sponsors and the awesome members of the Insurgency on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can join the Insurgency on Patreon by following the links in the description for patreon.com/O'Donnell. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts every day. So until next time, everybody, be free.